Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, filling in for Steve Jones, here's Kevin Herr.
Welcome back to hour number two of the Steve Jones Show. A best of Steve Jones yet today and all this week as Steve takes a little bit of vacation this week and gets us into full swing for football season with Penn State, Bucknell, NFL football, high school football. All that will be part of a very busy rest of the month of August when he returns from his summer break, we'll call it. Coming up in the next few moments, we're going to have Brandon Gouton of BleedingGreenNation.com. Brandon is our Eagles correspondent. He'll get us caught up on everything that's happened. Last hour, we talked with Merrill Reese before the NFL draft. Now, Brandon will get us updated on everything that's been going on since the NFL draft and minicamp. We had a conversation with him in June. That's coming up in the next few minutes. Michael Weinrib of Seasons of Saturdays, the book. We'll have his conversation with Steve in the next half hour as well. And we'll sneak in Neil Coulong with some Steelers news and notes. Right now, Brandon Gouton on the Best of the Steve Jones Show.
Brandon, welcome back. It is great to have you on the show.
Hey, it's always good to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right, so how about your evaluation about OTAs and the Philadelphia Eagles? What in the end, what was the buzz that came out of all that?
Well, just from the first day, I think there was a lot of information learned. The safety picture is a little bit more clear now. Apparently, they're putting Walter Thurman there. Obviously, he was signed as a cornerback. Everyone thought he was going to get kind of a shot there, especially in the slot, because that's where he's played for most of his career in the NFL. But now it looks like he's actually going to be the favorite to start next to Malcolm Jenkins. Elsewhere in the secondary, you have Nolan Carroll looking like the favorite to start at cornerback across from Byron Maxwell. And so those are the two of the biggest things right out of the jump, just what the new look secondary looks like.
So that's the key there. Everybody's going to obviously want to talk about Tim Tebow and where he fits in this. It sounds like Chip Kelly thought he got better as time went.
Yeah, Chip has been pumping Tim Tebow up all offseason about how he's made improvement, and there's been a lot of talk about that. From what I've seen and what other media members I think will back me up on this too, is just that from what we've seen in the practices so far, he just really does not look that improved. I think, you know, it still takes a very long time to get the ball out, and then even then, it's just not a pretty ball. I think part of the thing going on here is that he is new to the offense. He only signed not too long before their spring workouts began. So obviously there's some kind of learning curve there. You think back to last year when Mark Sanchez looked really rough in the Eagles spring practices, but as soon as he turned it around in training camp, and now this year he even looks great. So maybe there's a bit of a learning curve there, but you really do not see a lot of improvement from Tim Tebow.
When you walk out of this thing, what are some of the question marks that you have that weren't resolved in all of this?
I think you look at the offensive line right away, especially when the team releases Evan Mathis, who has been a starter at them for left guard, and not only a starter, but a high-quality starter as well. And you cut him, and you get nothing for him. Now, their offensive line is already a concern because they have not drafted an offensive lineman since Lane Johnson in 2013, and they haven't really signed anyone either. So you have this offensive line with question marks already, especially when it comes to depth. And you cut one of your starters, I mean, that just there's a chain reaction there. And it looks like the Eagles are really high on Allen Vrabel, who's really only been a journeyman in the NFL. He had 7 starts at the Packers way back, I think, in 2008 or so. So it's been a while. And, you know, is he going to be a good starter? The team is high on him. I don't really know. I can't say how good he's going to be. And then at right guard, they don't even have a clear starter. It's either going to be Matt Tobin, who is a young player who they're high on, or a guy like Andrew Gardner, who probably just more of a backup level caliber player. So the offensive line is the real question mark with this team.
Yeah, you follow a team day by day, week by week, like you do. And you get a feel, well, if they're a little bit better here, they can do this. If they're a little bit better there, they can do this. Is this different because it appears in many areas as a radical changeover in just a year?
Yeah, there's been so much change, and you do wonder how that's going to impact everything, just the turnover. And not only change just from a big scale, but at really important positions too. Quarterback, you know, starting running back is different. The offensive line, like you said, is going to look different. You're going to wonder how, a group like that, where you think chemistry and things like that is really important, you wonder how they're going to gel. I think it's really going to be interesting to see how this group shapes up over the summer and then early on in the season. Maybe this is a thing where the Eagles kind of get off to a slow start in the season, but maybe they're building as the season goes on, or maybe they get off to a slow start and that's really going to knock them down for the rest of the season.
Very few people have talked about Ryan Matthews coming into this mix. I mean, because obviously, you know, Murray was the NFL's leading rusher last year. Mm-hmm. What's the impression you get of him?
You know, it's hard to get a great sense in these drills because they're non-contact, and obviously the defenders aren't really able to tackle anyone. But what I can say is I do think he looks real natural as a pass catcher. I think he has good hands. I think, you know, they're going to be using him not only there, but the Eagles staff has also raved about him, not only Chip Kelly, but Deuce Staley, the running back. So it's, as well said, you know, they're really impressed with Ryan Matthews. They love his size. They love that he's not only is he big, he's really fast, too. I think that's a guy who, you know, he's going to get touches in the game where the defenses are going to be worn out from having to deal with a guy like DeMarco Murray, who's also big and fast and physical. And then they can put Ryan Matthews in, who's fresh because he's been on the bench all game. He's not really tired or anything. And then I think you have to deal with that. And I think the plan there is defenses are going to be tired and worn out. And now you have to deal with a fresh guy coming off the bench and just running through people. So I think that they do have a role cut out for him. And I think he was such obviously a talented player going into that year's draft, first running back drafted, was drafted to really replace the Ladainian Tomlinson. Just has struggled in San Diego to stay healthy. I think now he's in a spot where he doesn't really have to be the guy. He can be a talented role player, and I think, you know, that might be a role where he can thrive.
All right, outside, with the moves made outside, can Matthews outside be a number one receiver, the kid out of Vanderbilt?
Yeah, I don't think there's been a lot of talk about how he's going to be on the outside more often. I don't think that's going to be quite the case. I think he might get more looks there than he did last year. Last year, 92% of his routes were from the slot, so he was pretty much exclusively a slot receiver. I think this year, that might change a little bit. I think that number could go down from 92, maybe 80% or so, something around there. But I think in the spring practices, he was lining up in the slot a lot still. I think the Eagles feel like his size and his ability there is a matchup they like. I think he's going to be really good in year two. I think you saw last season he kind of got off to a slow start. I don't think Nick Foles and him had the best chemistry. I don't know why exactly. I think, you know, a guy like Mark Sanchez came in, and he really likes to work the inside of the field. And, you know, obviously the Eagles are hoping Sanchez won't be the starter for them, but I think Bradford might be able to pick up the chemistry with him. And the thing with Jordan Matthews is he's really impressive because he's big and he has all these skills and he's fast, but his stamina is what makes him really impressive. He gets the ball, makes a catch, and he's running back to the line of scrimmage, and he's ready to take off again. I don't think he's a guy who gets tired, and I think that's a huge thing in the offense, like Chip Kelly, where conditioning and everything is so key. They just want to be able to really just outwork their opponents.
All right. You mentioned that idealistically they wouldn't want Mark Sanchez to be the starting quarterback. In your mind, is there going to be a battle at least in the first couple of weeks between those two guys, or is it really Bradford's job?
I really think it's Bradford's job. The only situation where I see Sanchez starting is if Bradford is less than 100% healthy. Bradford would really, really have to struggle, and Sanchez would have to play really, really, really well. And I don't see that. I think Sanchez has had a great spring. I think he's a high-quality backup who the Eagles would love to have if, you know, Bradford goes down for a couple games here or there. But I don't think you're ultimately contending with Mark Sanchez at quarterback. I think he's just more of a guy who, like I said, you know, Bradford, maybe he has to miss a couple games in a stretch at some point, and I think you can feel good about Sanchez, you know, starting and not having to worry about your season going down the drain with him behind line behind center.
What's the strength of this football team, do you think, going in?
Well, I think you look at their front seven, and they were just so dominant last year. That's highlighted, obviously, by Fletcher Cox, who's only 24, and he's only an ascending player. Hasn't really gotten some of the attention he deserves, hasn't really made the Pro Bowl yet. He was like a sixth alternate last year, which is kind of ridiculous. He's really talented, and that whole front seven is a really, really talented group. It's almost too talented. They have a trio of inside linebackers with Michael Kendricks and D'Amico Ryans and Kiko Alonso. I mean, that's a really quality group there. Brandon Graham and Connor Barwin should be good on the outside. And then, like you said, you have Fletcher Cox, Benny Logan at nose tackle, and Cedric Thornton. And then Vinny Curry coming off the bench. So not only do they have starters, but they have depth there as well. I think what they really want to do there is be able to stop the run and rush the passer, and that's something they did really good last year.
Alonzo was expensive because they gave up LeSean McCoy. He's also coming off an injury. Where is he right now?
Yeah, he's fully healthy. No setbacks for him at all. Full participation in the spring practices and everything. I think he was even a little surprised at how healthy he feels. He said he's feeling great. He looked great. He's really a player that's going to stand out, especially in these non-contact drills, because he's a guy who can drop into coverage and bat balls down and make plays, a guy who can really stick with the tight ends and even maybe some of the wide receivers he's asked to cover. So I think he's a guy who's going to be kind of almost an underrated addition, because you just look at the Eagles offseason and it's been really crazy. I think you can almost forget about the addition of him and just the fact that the Eagles lost LeSean McCoy. He kind of gets shadowed in that. I think he's going to be really good for them.
What about the special teams part of it? What's your thought on that? Because Sproles improved them, as dynamic as DeSean Jackson is, Sproles improved them on consistency on returns. But what about the kicking part of this?
Yeah, a kick returner, they added some talent this offseason. You know, they added Nelson Aguilar. He wasn't especially dangerous on that. In college, he was more of a better punt returner, but it seems like they're going to give him a look there. I think Josh Huff is going to be the favorite to start. That was a guy who he had a touchdown return in preseason last year against the Bears. He also had one regular season against the Titans. I think Josh Huff has had a great offseason. He looks a lot more faster and a lot more explosive. I think that's a guy that, you know, could really make a big leap from being a rookie to his year two. So I think you look at that, and I think he's going to be really good as the kick returner. And not only that, but just the unit as a whole. They still have a lot of strong special teams players. They added Sayi Azirotutu this offseason. They lost the guys like James Casey and Brad Smith, but they still have a strong group there. I think they could easily be a top five special teams unit again in 2015.
All right. Obviously, this changeover in the roster has also changed personalities on the team. Is there a sense on your part that the personality matches more of what Chip Kelly wants?
I would say so. I feel like, you know, this is year three, and I feel like Chip Kelly has, and especially with him taking over essentially as the general manager now that he oversees the player personnel department, I feel like he's had the time to really make his mark on this team and get the players he wants. He's kind of gotten rid of the malcontents. You know, you released DeSean Jackson, traded away LeSean McCoy, you know, Evan Mathis, there was a contract dispute, now he's gone. I really think he's shaping the roster in his image. And is that going to lead to wins? I don't know. I think it'll be interesting to see, but I definitely think he's forming the team that he believes is going to be able to win. And I guess at this point, that's what you really have to hope for, because if you're going to give him that power, you're saying, you know, we believe in you, and if we're going down, we're going down with you. You know, this is all going to be on you. So there's really no excuses for him. It's all about what he can do and what he shaped this team to be.
Brandon, it's always a pleasure. Thanks so much for the information. We appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Brandon Gowton, BleedingGreenNation.com. Our conversation with Brandon in June, getting us caught up on Eagles football. Now we'll go the other side of the state, in the western side of the state, to the Steelers. Neil Coulong from now the USA Today article writer will be coming up with us next on the Best of the Steve Jones Show.
All right, Steelers fans, we've gotten the Eagles fans up to speed, Redskins as well. Time to catch you up. And a conversation we just had a couple of weeks ago with Neil Coulon, who is now part of the USA Today sports writers group. He's catching us up on Steelers football on the Steve Jones Show.
Let's get to the lull before the storm with the Steelers. When you look at them going into this camp, what is there to like and what is there to be concerned about?
Let's start with the concerns, because I think that's more of the story with this team heading into 2015. Not that it's bad, but they're going to succeed or fail this year based on their ability to get after the quarterback. And you and I have talked about this quite a bit over the years, in the fact that this team hasn't been able to generate consistent pressure on any quarterback that they've faced, really, in the last couple seasons. Their takeaway numbers are affected by that as well. They're bottom third of the league as far as takeaways over the last 3 years. They're probably right at that point as well with sacks. And it's not necessarily just getting sacks. It's hurries, knockdowns, things like that. Those are pressure statistics as well, and they're just not getting that as much. Quarterbacks are making easier reads against their defense, and they're delivering the ball a lot quicker than they used to. They're not hanging on to it. Their teams aren't running lots of deep routes at them anymore. They're spreading them out, running things short, and they're having success in doing it. On top of that, they're giving up yards against the run. You know, that's something this defense didn't do when it was at its best. In fact, I'd argue all the best defenses stop the run. I mean, you have to shut that part of the game down, and you have to make a team one-dimensional. And the Steelers have struggled to do that game in and game out over the last couple seasons. However it is that you want to break it down, it comes down to pressure. You know, good coverage comes from pressure. And if they don't have good coverage, it's not as if quarterbacks are releasing the ball in a second and a half, 40 yards down the field. You know, guys are getting open, sure, but quarterbacks don't have any problem completing passes. And they're going to have to fix that, plain and simple. They have too good of an offense, and this is, you know, the good thing to look at for the team this year. They're loaded offensively. They have maybe the best group of skill position players in the NFL. They have a great quarterback. They have their entire offensive line, including their coach, coming back for a second year. That hasn't happened in quite a while. There's a lot of optimism on the offensive side of the ball. And if the defense can get pressure, I think you even with the tough schedule that they have, I think you can see another division championship caliber team.
All right, let's get to the defense. Obviously, changing coordinators. But Dick LeBeau left, and what he did in Pittsburgh schematically over the years, he did some brilliant things, which then leads me to think this is a talent issue. Where are they lacking in talent on defense that has caused them to not get the pressure you just talked about?
I think it's a combination of talent's kind of a fluid term. Jarvis Jones, his rookie year, his second year, was not talented. It doesn't mean that he can't be, and I think the latest news surrounding the team is testament to that. Cam Hayward signs a six-year contract worth $60 million. In 2012, if you even suggested that was going to happen, you get laughed off the air in an instant. He improved himself. He developed as a player, and he turned into an excellent defensive end. Players like Jones need to reach that kind of development growth. He hasn't done that. He hasn't shown that. He's been injured. The short answer to your question, though, off the edge, really. I mean, James Harrison is an effective player. He's not obviously playing at the defensive player of the year level that he used to, but he's an effective player, a guy that they just gave a two-year contract to when he turns 37.
Right.
If Jarvis Jones is not capable of beating out a 37-year-old player that they can't get off the roster, who's, you know, an above-average player, you're right. You've got a talent issue. On the other side of the ball, the Steelers gave $9.75 million guaranteed on a transition tag to Jason Worlds, and he gave him 7.5 sacks. He was on the field for 1,000 snaps last year and didn't really develop all that much pressure. He was an okay player. You can't have okay if the primary means of your pressure is generated from your outside linebackers. You have to have outstanding. You have to have excellent. And they don't have excellent players in that regard.
Their inside linebackers, I think you're going to see a big step up this year. Ryan Shazier is going to be a very, very good football player. And he showed that at the end of last season. Stephon Tuitt's going to be a good player. All of these things will help a secondary that probably doesn't have as much talent as the front seven does.
One final question, then I'll let you go, Neil. And that deals with Le'Veon Bell not being involved in the first two games. So they go out and they sign D'Angelo Williams. LeGarrette Blount did not want to be in a spot role. And look, I have no dog in the hunt. So when I say I think Le'Veon Bell, to me, is the best all-around running back in the NFL, that's not a Steeler fan speaking. That's just somebody objectively looking around the league and saying, I don't think anybody does all the things that he does as well as he does. Is Williams have, because, you know, he had to do some sharing down in Carolina at times with Stewart, does he have that mentality that when Bell gets back that to accept a role with this team?
Well, I would think, considering what happened with Blount, probably the first thing they told D'Angelo Williams is, we have the best all-around running back in the NFL. You're not going to play much after the first three games of the season, which we think he's going to be missing. So we're going to sign you. We're probably going to give you the ball at a higher level than you ever got in Carolina, except for the 2008 season. And then after that, you might get five snaps a game. Are you cool with that? Because if you are, here's your contract.
Okay.
It only makes sense that they try to avoid the situation with Blount. Now, to be honest, Blount was told something differently when he signed. He was told that it was going to be a much more evenly divided rate of carries between the two. His carries fell off, as did his effectiveness with those carries, as Bell increased his ability. I thought, I'm on record as saying this, I thought at this point last year, Blount was the better running back of the two. Just based on Bell's rookie film and what Blount is capable of doing, I saw it being more of like a 60-40 type of role, because I didn't think Bell had an advantage at that day over Blount in terms of experience, in terms of vision, footwork. I think Bell exceeded everyone's expectations last year, and he's turned into, exactly as you described him, the best all-around running back in the NFL. The guy can't be – I don't think they can guard him in the passing game. And that's something that no other running back can boast. I mean, he's a young LaDainian Tomlinson right now, just without the great running ability. But he's going to continue to develop that. They know that. He's going to get 90% of the carries this season, if not, you know, all of them beyond weeks 1, 2, and 3. He's a high-level player, and Williams is going to serve probably as the team's feature back the first three games. And then after that, barring injury, he's not going to get the ball much. Maybe if Bell's shoe comes off or something like that in a no-huddle drive, he might get in and get a carry or two. But it's Bell's team, and it should be.
Neil, an absolute pleasure. Great to hear you again. Thanks for taking some time for us.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for having me.
Neil Coolong, catch us up on the Steelers. Coming up, Michael Wenrib, Seasons of Saturdays, as we shift to college football after the news here on the Steve Jones Show.
This year marks Sunbury Motor Company's 100th year in business, and we will be keeping the same tried and true values we've had ever since we opened our doors, guaranteeing your car buying experience will be smooth and hassle-free. No spinning a wheel for specials you don't need or want. No pushy sales staff pouncing on you as soon as you arrive. No sideshow yelling. Since we began back in 1915, we have strived to be your most trusted friend when it comes to all of your new car needs, whether that's in sales or service. We strive to offer you as many viable options as we possibly can. Sunbury Motor Company always carries a line of few other auto dealers in our area can compete with our inventory of Ford, Hyundai, Kia, and Lincoln vehicles. There should be no problems with finding the right vehicle to fit your needs. Our friendly and trustworthy staff is knowledgeable in all of our products and stand ready to answer all of your questions and meet all of your needs. In honor of 100 years in business, SMC is introducing the all-new Auto Club, where Sunbury Motors will pay you for every mile you drive. Be sure to ask us about our Auto Club benefits. Sunbury Motors in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza and at sunburymotors.com. Proudly owned by the Mertz family since 1915.
Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, filling in for Steve Jones, here's Kevin Herr.
Welcome back to the best of the Steve Jones Show, as Steve is on R&R. Kevin Herr in the Sunbury Motors Studio East all this week, bringing you some of the best interviews we've had over the last several months, recapping some of the football today with the NFL, and recapping our conversation with Merrill Reese, Larry Michaels, the voice of the Eagles and the Redskins, Brandon Gauton from Bleeding Green Nation, Neil Coulong talking about the Steelers. Now that we've done some NFL stuff, let's shift gears a little bit and discuss a little bit of college football and just the overall college football picture and experience with author Michael Weinrib. He's the author of Seasons of Saturdays. Here's Steve's conversation with him on the Best of the Steve Jones Show.
Michael, welcome. It is great to have you with us on the show.
Well, yeah, first of all, it's fun to be back here. This is where I grew up. I wasn't born here, but I've lived here since I was 5 years old. And I don't think I would have written a book about college football if I hadn't grown up in this town. So a lot of it is infused through my memories of being a Penn State fan and growing up a Penn State fan. And I kind of wanted to extrapolate on that a little bit. And so the book is sectioned into 14 chapters.
Yeah.
Each chapter is a different game. And the game is sort of a jumping off point to discuss different issues about college football. You know, it's such a sport on the brink of such change right now.
Yeah.
And everything, it just seems up in the air a little bit. And so I just want to go, you know, it starts at the beginning. It starts in 1869 with the very first college football game.
Rutgers-Princeton.
And then it goes through, and there's a couple of Penn State games in there because those were the games that I remember as a kid. Yeah. You know, that Penn State-Alabama Sugar Bowl in 78.
Right.
The Fiesta Bowl in 87. Yeah. You know, and it talks a lot, you know, a lot of it's filtered through my experience as a fan. And just gets at sort of the cultural history of college football and also my own personal history of college football and just what it all means and that kind of thing.
It's a history in 14 Saturdays. So you've discussed three of them immediately, which are three watershed moments for different reasons. Now let's get to the how much then went into Michael selecting the other 11, and how much, you know, what ended up on the cutting room floor versus down, because you had to make hard decisions on the other 11.
Yeah, well, part of it was, you know, you go to Wikipedia or whatever, and you look up games of the century for college football. How many games of the century are there on that list? There's probably 20 on that list. At this
Oklahoma, I mean, Nebraska.
Yeah, only college football could have 20 games of the century, right?
In one season.
Yeah, exactly. So you go back, and I went through that list, and I thought, well, which of these games sort of carry a deeper meaning, or if there's something here that I think I can sort of use to discuss bigger ideas. So, you know, I write about, but then some of them aren't games of the century at all.
Right.
Some of them, it's like when Miami beat the crap out of Notre Dame in, you know, 1980, whatever it was, 88, 87,
right,
something like that.
That was the brawl game before the game.
Oh, actually, it might have been even earlier than
that.
Yeah, it was when Jerry Faust was his last game and everything.
Yeah.
But that was kind of the beginning of this Miami attitude and the Miami dynasty. And, you know, I grew up hating Miami because I was a Penn State fan. But then, you know, I sort of came around on them because I saw what they were trying to do and the way they were trying to break out of the mold of what college football was and everything
right.
like that. So I sort of, you know, have developed a grudging respect for them over the years. So that was like, I picked that game because it meant something, I think, culturally.
It was like 58 to nothing.
58 to 7 or something like that?
Yeah,
exactly. So some of those games, there's some games like that. There's some games like, you know, there's one that's, it's actually, you know, there's one game where it's like, I don't even talk about the game at all, but it's the Rose Bowl when Ohio State was supposed to go in the early 1960s, I want to say, with Woody Hayes, and the faculty decided that they didn't want to go because the Big Ten was trying to sort of, a lot of the Big Ten faculty was trying to de-emphasize football at that point.
Right.
You know? So it's more about Woody Hayes and this idea of what the Big Ten deciding what it was going to be and whether it was going to keep up with the SEC and all these other conferences. So, you know, the games, a lot of them are jumping off points, and then some of them, it's like it really gets deeper into the game itself, you know.
People don't realize that there have been those movements over time in the 60s trying to de-emphasize football. Penn State went through that period in the late 20s into the 30s where there was a de-emphasis on football. And people don't realize that there have been hurdles to overcome in that area.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a constant thing with college football. If you go back, you know, when I read about that first game, I talk a lot, you know, kind of about that, the entire 19th century and football developing in the Ivy League and Harvard and Yale. And you have the president of Harvard who doesn't want college football to exist, basically. And then you have Yale building up this power under the Walter Camp, who was kind of the first big coach. And then you have that movement you probably know about in the late 1800s when Teddy Roosevelt gets involved, and there's all this violence in college football, and people think maybe it's dying at that point. You know?
And Roosevelt loved football, but the violence of it, that's when they were looking. I know, and it's a different book, but Dave Revson looked into that in his book, as a matter of fact.
Absolutely. In fact, I would recommend reading Dave's book, and then mine sort of picks up where his left off, you know. I think, you know, he got out a lot of that stuff, too. But the interesting thing that he brings up and that I bring up, too, in that first chapter is that people were having the same arguments then that they're having today. You know, the arguments about violence, the arguments about what college football's place in the bigger culture of a university is. You know, we've had all these discussions at Penn State in the last few years with everything that's gone on, you know. And it's certainly like that's part of what I wanted to do is just go back and say, you know, here's where we came from. And here's over the years kind of how we got here. And here's why I still have this great passion and love for this sport, even though it's so deeply flawed in a lot of ways.
The single most influential individual to me in the history of Southern football played at Southern California and not a Southern school. And that is Sam Bam Cunningham.
Mm-hmm.
Who against Alabama scored 4 touchdowns.
Mm-hmm.
And Bear Bryant, who had been trying to integrate, had his example.
Yeah, and I think that was the breakthrough moment. And I think there were a lot of moments before that, too, where you can see Alabama slowly pushing in that direction. It's such an interesting thing.
He wanted to.
Yeah, I mean, apparently he wanted to back when he was at Kentucky.
Kentucky, Texas A&M, everywhere. He wanted to, Maryland.
Yeah, and so, you know, one of the years I read about is 1966, which was that year that Notre Dame tied Michigan State. Yeah. Notre Dame winds up winning the national championship, but Alabama also went undefeated that year. Mm-hmm. But they had an all-white roster at that point, and they didn't even get considered for the national championship, in part because I think they had an all-white roster, and, you know, so you can see how
that was one of those games of the century, too.
Yes,
Michigan State Notre Dame was one of those games of the century. If I recall, Coley O'Brien, Terry Hanratty gets hurt. Mm-hmm. Coley O'Brien is a diabetic.
You're right.
And they put him in, and Ara Parseghian is concerned that Coley O'Brien, you know, it's a little bit different in 1966 than it is now in terms of insulin.
Yeah.
And so they kneel on the ball, and he wins the national title.
Yeah, because there's, a minute and a half left, and they've got to drive downfield. And you look at football today, and you're like, if a team has a minute and a half, that's like a full quarter at this point. You know? Yeah, exactly. It's like, why would you not go for it? There's a game a couple years ago where Alabama scored in like 30 seconds, you know, or something like that.
Right.
So, you know, but back then, it was a totally different game.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Notre Dame sits on the ball, which is probably a smart move because of what you mentioned about Coley O'Brien and everything, and also because Ara knew that if he plays for the tie, frankly, Notre Dame's going to get the vote at that point.
Right.
You know?
He knows.
Yeah, exactly. So that was part of it. And then you have that whole element with Alabama in there, too. And so the chapters I wrote about that, the late 60s and early 70s, there's a chapter about the Richard Nixon year, which I'm sure you know all about, you know, with Penn State.
Which, by the way, ESPN will be doing a 30 for 30 on.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
Yes, ESPN will be doing a 30 for 30 on the 1969 Texas-Arkansas game.
Okay, yeah, I seem to have a knack for writing about things that they then do 30 for 30 about, which I guess is a good sign.
That's a good sign. Yeah. It means you're on to something.
Yeah, exactly. But that was obviously such a huge year for Penn State, and it's weird to see. It's interesting to see. You know, you always that dovetail between sports and politics is always this kind of this uncomfortable, discomforting thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's a moment where it was like sports and politics were directly intertwined because Richard Nixon goes down there in order to appeal to Southern voters, not realizing that he's going to alienate the entire state of Pennsylvania by doing this.
It was Bud Wilkinson talked to him about the Southern strategy.
Right.
And that's what they came up with. What did you learn that you didn't know as you went through this?
Oh, a lot of stuff. I mean, a lot of the things, like I had always heard the Nixon, you know, Paterno stories. I'd always heard the famous Joe line about, you know, how did Nixon know so much about college football and so little about Watergate? So I knew, like, the contours of that whole story.
Mm-hmm.
one thing that really interested me.
That wasn't my favorite line from him.
No.
His favorite line for, on this story.
On this story, okay.
Yes. He gets called by an AP writer at home. I think it's near the end of the game or whatever. I think it was at the end of the game, and they present. He said, "And your thoughts on it?" He goes, "I wasn't watching. I was babysitting." Right? Which, of course, he watched every second.
Right, of course. Absolutely. That's a good line, too. But one of the other things that surprised me, too, was, you know, I moved here to State College in 1978, and so that 78 team, that was like, you know, I was a little kid watching those games. I have very vague memories mm-hmm. of that team and that 79 Sugar Bowl, thinking that, like, this was the hugest, biggest game I'd ever seen. It was obviously the national championship game. But if you go back and you look at that season, USC beat Alabama.
Yes,
and USC
did.
Was a one-loss team. Yep. And USC probably should have been playing Penn State for the national championship instead of Alabama. Mm-hmm. But because, you know, there was a lot of sympathy for Bear Bryant at that point. He was sort of breaking down physically. He was kind of nearing the end of his career. Mm-hmm. And I think he got a little bit of a sympathetic vote at that point. I think he knew very well how to play the politics of college football in a way that a lot of other coaches didn't. In fact, Joe often didn't play the politics mm-hmm. as well as Bear Bryant did, and I think that probably cost Penn State in some of those seasons.
Sure.
But it was interesting to look back, especially on that year, and see you know, how much nuance there was in there and how the things that I thought I understood about that year and about that season were so much affected by other things and by politics and by all that other stuff that infiltrates college football all the time. Yeah.
What's the latest game in your book?
Latest game is last year's Iron Bowl.
Yes.
I had to get that in there.
You had to. Yeah.
And I think, you know, the reason I wanted to get that in there, not just because of the way it ended, but because it happened to Nick Saban, who is this guy who we see as sort of the ultimate modern football coach in that he's prepared for every eventuality. Mm-hmm. He's very much like a CEO or a bureaucrat or something like that, where he just kind of, you got the sense that he was prepared for everything. And then this one thing happens to him that he was absolutely not prepared for. He's got a bunch of fat guys on the field for this field goal attempt.
Yeah.
And, you know, and Auburn beats him. And it just kind of shows the inherent unpredictability of college football. That's why, to me, this is the best sport in the world, is because there's just that imperfection to it. There's those inherent little flaws to it that elevate it above every other sport.
Well, he called the timeout, so he could kick it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
He called the timeout,
yeah.
So he could kick a 57-yard field goal.
Yep.
Yeah, that's people forget he's 8-7 in bowl games. I haven't. I think he's an awesome, awesome coach, but he's also not perfect.
Yeah, yeah, it's true, but I think there was that sense that he
aura.
Was perfect.
He has developed an aura.
There was an aura about him, and just the way he's able to recruit these days and the way that they're able to, you know, I thought this year would be the year that they would completely fall off.
Yeah,
and they're still really good, you know?
Still right in the thick of it.
Yeah.
You, the 87 Fiesta Bowl is, and probably just based on how television is today, always will be the highest rated college football game ever. It had 24
something like that.
And it's never going to be approached because there's 7,000 channels on right now.
Yeah.
So you split the audience up that many ways. So when you look at that, what did that do by matching up one versus two, having the Fiesta Bowl move it to January 2nd, and give it the showcase? What did it do for the game to launch it to the point we're at now?
I think it was the prelude to the playoff. It was one of the first preludes to the playoff. Because before that point, it was pretty difficult to find, to match up those top two teams. You know, it didn't happen that often. And this was a sense that, like, we are going to specifically match up these two teams. It worked out, obviously, because Miami wasn't in a conference at that point. They were both independents,
yep.
Right? And there were a lot of independents back then. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that they moved it back a day, the fact that you probably remember Ronald Reagan speaking at halftime, you know, mm-hmm. that sort of lent it this aura of almost being a
sure.
Super Bowl.
Yep.
You know, and it just felt like the hype for that game was so huge. The whole good versus evil thing, which seems kind of crazy in retrospect, obviously.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was... That that was such a huge moment for me too, personally. Just you know, just the memories of that game and what it meant, and I do think it's sort of, you can draw a direct line from that game to where we are today, where we have this playoff. You know.
Well, the media surrounding you, I remember one of the big advantages that they had by inviting Penn State was actually a guy a lot of people would not think of, and that was Bud Tallman. Bud Tallman was Penn State's sports information director at the time, associate athletic director, but he was Penn State's sports information director. Bud had worked 7 Super Bowls for the NFL, and the media was the equivalent of a Super Bowl, and he knew how to handle it, all the ins and outs. That was actually a side story that's very important to that, because that's the kind of coverage you got.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think, you know, Bud was obviously, he was a little bit before my time when I was here at the Collegiate.
Sure, of course.
But yeah, I mean, I think the impact that he had on that, and then the impact that some of the other people had who were directly involved with the bowl, who managed to get that matchup. I think it was, I can't remember if it was Jimmy Johnson who didn't want that matchup.
Johnson did not want to did not want the matchup.
Right, that's what it was.
He did not want the matchup. In fact, I'd covered the Miami East Carolina game, their last regular season game, because Penn State was playing basketball in the AMI Classic, which, by the way, Penn State won. Hey, Brian Allen was the MVP, just to let you know, and anything can happen. And I mean, if you want to do one of those believe in miracles moments, that's it. But I was able to cover the game. It was Thanksgiving night.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember interviewing all their players and him, and they were not enamored with the idea of playing Penn State. They wanted to go to the Sugar Bowl.
Yes.
Which they had been destroyed in by Tennessee the year before.
Yeah, and I think what happened was one of the Fiesta Bowl officials basically baited Jimmy Johnson and said...
Bruce Skinner did.
Right, and he's basically said, well, okay, you guys are afraid to play Penn State, that's fine, you know, and sort of appealed to Jimmy Johnson's ego and got him to agree to that game.
I can't believe you could appeal to Jimmy Johnson's ego.
Can you imagine
that?
I'm
stunned by that. I'm taken aback. Just one final question, then we'll let you go. You see it come to fruition, and there's your body of work. And I recommend strongly that people buy it, because I had a chance to go in the bookstore and look through it, and I'm going to get my copy, because I think it's that good. To see it in reality, how do you feel now to see it there?
Oh, it's cool. I mean, this one feels really good to me because it was so personal, and... just because so much of what I was writing about is what I picked up in this town,
yeah,
at this university, you know, and it felt like I could tell some of those, yeah, stories about my memories of those games. It's definitely the most personal book I've written,
yeah,
but even though there's a lot in there that I hope people pick up in terms of history of the game,
sure,
history of the sport and the culture of the sport and everything like that. Yeah, it feels really good. It always feels really good to have a book out, but especially with this one where it was like you kind of, I feel this community. Yeah,
yeah.
You know?
See, I felt like this one's personal. That's why I asked it.
Yeah, no, I think it is. I think there's a lot about growing up in this town and about like everything that's happened in the last few years has,
yeah,
been pretty emotionally wrenching, you know. And I think that's part of what this book was for me to kind of have some catharsis with that stuff too, you know.
The Season of Saturdays. Michael Weinreb, thanks so much for taking the time to carve out a couple of minutes with us, because I strongly recommend pick up a copy, take a look at it. If you love history and you love storytelling, this book has it.
Michael Weinreb, the author of Seasons of Saturdays, and Steve's conversation with him. Coming up tomorrow and the rest of this week, we're going to talk a little baseball with Chris Wheeler, the former voice of the Philadelphia Phillies. We'll also remember Fran Fischer and have a conversation that he and Lou Prado had. If you missed that conversation, we've run it one or two times over some holidays. It's definitely one that is worth listening to again. Talk about two guys and the history of Penn State football. Those two guys are the encyclopedia. When you throw Steve Jones in there yet, well, you can only imagine what that's like. So a great conversation with those guys coming up as we remember the late Fran Fischer and, of course, Jack Ham. We had a conversation with him a couple of weeks ago. We'll recap that as part of our Best of the Steve Jones Show all this week on News Radio 1070 WKOK, online at WKOK.com, and on the WKOK app. And don't forget, you can also hear the podcast at SteveJonesShow.com. More tomorrow on the Best of the Steve Jones Show. Kevin Herb, thanks for joining us. Talk to you tomorrow.